Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Richard Maurer of the Anchorage Daily News, and the Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. Steve, four Japanese climbers die on Mount McKinley earlier this week and one survives. What do we know about the tragedy, and what is the Park Service and others saying, and the lessons that can be drawn from this, if any, at this point?
Well, yeah, I don't know if there's any lessons other than the fact that this is a dangerous mountain, and you have to practice the utmost care when you're climbing or descending the mountain. This is just something where it's an area that's prone to avalanches. It's a 35 degree slope. These people were traversing through this area, and it wasn't exactly what you'd call a large avalanche. It was about 3-4 feet tall, not enough to actually kill anybody in its own right. But this avalanche swept people into a crevasse, and that's what caused all the trauma to these climbers. One person, Mr. Oji, he was able to get out of it. He was able to climb down to a base camp and get further assistance there. I think they were all strung together, all roped together. It seemed like they were practicing good climbing procedures.
Well, then the rope must have broke for the one gentleman who survived.
That's right, it did. That's what they found out, and it appears that this is going to be their final resting spot on that mountain in this crevasse. But the rope did break for this Mr. Oji, the fellow who did survive. And I don't think these folks did anything wrong. Not like the fellow who died earlier in the climbing season when he lost his backpack and decided to go down for it and slipped and fell. You've heard of things where people have just not been roped together, a fall takes them out. Things like that, where they're just not thinking through.
And one of the things I noticed is some of the climbers, maybe most of them in this group, were older.
Yes.
Is that becoming an issue about health concerns about older climbers?
I haven't heard that.
Things of that effect.
Yeah, there have certainly been older climbers on the mountains before, on the mountain before. But usually they're mixed in with the climbing party that maybe younger people, and you've got a guide with you as well who really knows the mountain. But yeah, this was kind of an older, on average,
climbing party. And had any of the people who died in this incident, had any of them climbed the mountain before?
I'm not aware of that, Michael. I haven't heard that, if they had any climbing experience on Denali or not. I think a lot of folks, it used to be anyways, with a lot of climbers, especially climbers from foreign countries, they'd come over and would not be prepared for the kind of weather, the kind of just cold weather that Denali can throw at climbers, and they would get in trouble that way. I think the Park Service has worked really hard over the years to educate climbers from the United States, from foreign countries, to let them know just exactly what kind of climate that they're going to endure climbing this mountain. It's a ferocious mountain.
I can't remember if you know how common is it for bodies to be unrecoverable on.
I want to say there's about 20 bodies that are still up there that have not been recovered.
And that's over 50 years or something. Longer than that.
Yeah, yeah. But there's been about, I think, 120 or so, 125 fatalities, if I remember correctly. So far this year, there's been 6. Last year, there were quite a few. There were about a dozen or so last year, if I remember correctly on that number as well. But there's been seasons where it's been relatively safe, and then there's been seasons like last year where so many things went wrong.
Thank you very much, Steve. Paul, former Senate candidate Joe Miller gets a $5,000 judgment against the Fairbanks North Star Borough, although actually it's really a settlement. There's some argument among the parties about the nouns and verbs that should be used here. This has taken more than a year of legal wrangling between the parties.
About 16
what happened, now. And is this finally over?
No, the judge has not yet approved it. Anything could happen between now and then. Things could happen afterwards even. The Fairbanks North Star Borough is not about to give up its bid for a record that it wanted, which it would have gotten probably this week. It had, going back to when all this started, back in the 2010 Senate race, information was released from somebody by somebody, anonymous letter, a source, to the Fairbanks Daily News Miner about his job history, Joe Miller's job history with the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Andrew Halcrow got part of it, and in the process of the election mess, it was asserted that, well, he can't ever be hired, can't be hired again by the borough. Well, newspaper sued, Daily News sued, Alaska Dispatch sued, I guess everybody sued. They jumped in, and in the release of those records, we find out that no, he wasn't. He's eligible for rehire after 3 years because he was let go because of some dispute over leave time. It had nothing to do with the other thing that was released, which was that he had tampered with computers at the borough to jury rig.
Can you explain to us this judgment that's a settlement?
Okay, the judgment that's a settlement, he had claimed he wanted, I think Dermot Colt, the Newsminer, figured it out, $160,000 in damages from all this information being released. He had sued, claiming that the borough mayor and the borough had released this surreptitiously. The borough said, we'll take you, we'll go to court with you. He says, well, I'll settle for $50,000. And I said, no, thank you. He said, I'll settle for $25,000. No. Then the borough says, well, I'll settle for nothing. He says, no. So here we are. And they go to court. They said, the borough says to him, we need to get this information from him. He settles the day before that information is due. So the net effect would be, from the outside anyway, the net effect would be that information never be released. The borough refuses to give that up. They're going ahead and see if they
can
get
it. It's formally called a judgment, and Miller declared victory, and the other side declared victory.
Yeah, right. And then who knows? I mean, it's basically a long, involved, expensive process that got cut short. And in the interim, Joe Miller for U.S. Senate has now become Citizens for Joe Miller. And the campaign account of $440,000 that's left in the first account has been transferred to the second account. So, that means, who knows?
And Miller did not was not required by the filing to reveal what he might be running for.
And that's one of the major points, is the borough suspects and has pretty much said they think he paid all his legal fees out of his campaign donation, which, as they said, would be a very artistic way to use those. So that's what they want to know. That's not what they're going to find out unless they can get a judge to, even though the case has been settled, judgment, whatever, unless that's all behind him, unless the judge said so.
Okay, thank you very much. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Richard Maurer of the Anchorage Daily News. Richard, you were there, the Fairbanks militiaman trial that went on for almost a month. Defense, there's so much to talk about. There's so much detail and so many interesting questions that were raised and interesting characters that came through there. But first of all, the defense, and there were three defense attorneys, tried to make this a First Amendment case. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the First Amendment definitely appeared many times in this case. But as we journalists know, the First Amendment is not an absolute right. I could be sued for libel or invasion of privacy. Schaefer Cox found out he could be convicted despite his use of the First Amendment in making speeches. He can be convicted for drawing up lists of people who could be killed for accumulating weapons that were illegal for him to possess without registering them. So I think he looked shocked as the verdicts were read, and I think he thought that. That he had an avenue to get out from under this case, and the jury said no.
And his attorney, Nelson Traverso, during his examination and re-examination, tried to bring this up again and again to make this into a First Amendment case.
That's right, and the jury was not buying that. There's so many things that interfered with his First Amendment. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You can't plot to overthrow the government. And there was very strong evidence that he was making lists, he was targeting people, that he was accumulating weapons and had established a core within his militia who would be willing to kill to protect either liberty or to protect Schaefer Cox.
If I might, one of the terms we heard numerous times in the course of the trial, mm-hmm. especially from the prosecutors, mm-hmm. was overt acts. I believe mm-hmm. that's what you're talking about here.
Exactly. Overt acts in furtherance of a conspiracy to
right.
conspiracy to accumulate unregistered weapons, conspiracy to murder federal officials.
Okay. Second, tell us about Judge Robert Bryan, our visiting judge from Tacoma.
As a person who's covered federal courts here for quite some time, Judge Bryan was a treat. He'd show up during breaks in the trial when the jury was out. He'd come into the courtroom in his shirt sleeves. I think many of our judges, I'd be shocked to see him in a grocery store on the weekend out not wearing their robes. I mean, that's how formal they are. He was very relaxed. He came up and talked to reporters a couple of times about issues that might come up during the course of the trial. Yet at the same time, he managed that case very well. There was very little going on that he was not controlling. But he controlled it in a very relaxed kind of way. Whenever there were objections, he would ponder them for a bit. You know, it was never seat of the pants. And it was very refreshing to see
him. In fact, if I remember correctly, there were several points when people would object and there'd mm-hmm. be this long silence and you could see the lawyers thinking, did he hear me or what's going on here? And he had, I think a couple times he said, you know, yeah, uh-huh. I hear you, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, he was hard of hearing and he did wear hearing assistance, but he was thinking each one through and he would keep you at the edge of your seat. Is this going to be sustained? Is this going to be overruled?
I had the impression, and I'd be curious about yours, that he was willing to give the defense, let them to go fairly far in their questioning and in some of their tactics, in the sense that he knew the kind of sentences that these defendants could face if they, you know, if they were convicted.
Well, he did, but he also let the prosecution. I think he was willing to have the narrative told in the courtroom.
Yeah,
there was a story. There were many stories that unfolded in that courtroom, and he was willing to let the jury, and he may have been curious himself. He was willing to hear the stories through. And even if that meant maybe expanding what would normally be heard in a trial, he was comfortable with that. And that could be his years of experience.
And the final thing was he seemed to be terrific in the, sort of the way he managed and showed this ongoing respect and concern for the jurors.
For the juror and for the people in the courtroom. I've never seen a judge swear in witnesses himself. It's usually the clerk who does that. He would swear them in and he said, don't just face the jury, face the courtroom. This is a public trial. The jury is a very important fact. The defense, the prosecution are very important. But let's not forget about the people on the outside of the bar. This is a public trial. And he was pretty insistent on that.
Yeah, and you remember right at the beginning when one of the attorneys, I think it was for the prosecutor, said mm-hmm. to somebody, please state your name for the record. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, you're not just stating it for the record. You're right. Stating it for this. All the people who are here.
Exactly. And people who might come to this trial to look at the record of this trial in the future. I mean, that's one of the reasons he saved. There was the transcripts of all the tapes, which were, you know, quasi-audible. The jury had the transcript. The parties had the transcript. And he took his copy of the transcript and said, by God, I'm going to put this in the record for the public in the future, because it's the only way to hear this material.
Next question. Are there any unsolved mysteries yet? For example, the fate of Bill Fulton.
Well, that we never really heard much about Bill Fulton enough. I mean, Bill Fulton testified, but there was Bill Fulton goes back to Joe Miller now. Was he working for the federal government at the time that he was Joe Miller's security, and at the time he arrested a reporter, which had a huge effect on Joe Miller's campaign, and it gets very, very tangled.
And for those
quickly.
Who may not have followed this as closely as those of us involved, Bill Fulton's role was what? He was the owner of a business and so forth.
He ran a business in it was a kind of an army surplus store, but it was a lot more in Spinard called the Drop Zone. You walk in, there'd be militia signs there. This business is. is basically a militia sponsor. Of course, he made a lot of money. One of the things you found out in this trial, militia members spend a lot of money at tactical stores, army surplus stores. They spend a fortune. They're the biggest, probably one of the biggest clients of these stores. And Drop Zone Bill, as he was known, supported the militia. Yet at the same time, why is he working with the feds? And he also ran a security business. He ran a security business on the side. He would track down felons. He'd be a bounty. He was a bounty hunter. And he was also in the security business. And as a guy in the security business, he protected Joe Miller from I don't know who, but as I guess
Tony
from reporters.
Hoffinger.
From Tony Hoffinger. Hoffinger. Poor Tony Hoffinger, who wound up in handcuffs during one of Joe Miller's appearances in Anchorage.
And now Mr. Fulton has entered, as we understand it, the witness protection program?
Well, he's not. The other witnesses in the witness protection program, the other confidential informant, Gerald J.R. Olson, but Fulton is not officially a member in the witness protection program, although he's kind of vanished. So he's in his own witness protection program, I guess.
Okay. Finally, there are several other militias in Alaska, including the Alaska Citizens Militia run by former Michigan leader Norm Olson.
Correct.
What does this mean to them?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Norm Olson, he has said over the course of this trial, he's definitely been one of Schaefer Cox's fans. There was a situation where the Schaefer Cox's militia had these secret telephones where they would be able to call each other on what they thought were secure lines and not be known. The red phone, the yellow phone, I don't know, all the phones. And Norm Olson had one of the secure phones. What his role was with Schaefer Cox, it's unclear. He did support him on his blog. But Norm said before the verdicts came out during the course of the trial that the significance of verdicts would affect his group as well. Here's something he posted: if Schaefer is convicted, it will validate that there are real enemies for them. But if he walks, it will let us know that the central government is no threat at all, which would mean we can just we can go about our business. What he has said is we need to practice security. We as militia, we have to be better than Schaefer Cox was in keeping our counsel to ourselves and not be.
Final question. The militia, part of the trial was the militia had a militia summit at the Millennium Hotel in here in Anchorage. How many people would show up for something like that? It was never clear to me from what happened at the trial.
Yeah, no, I have no idea. It was enough that a lot of things were going on. Fulton certainly had a role in the militia summit. Again, that's good business for him. Just like you go to any convention, there are booths set up. There was a little meeting up in Fairbanks, and Fulton had his little booth set up.
That was one of the most interesting part of this trial. I thought that we learned something about the business aspects of this that you just on a day-to-day basis wouldn't learn, because if he walked in there, they weren't going to tell you this.
Right, and we found out what militia members can get for Valentine's presents, and in one case it was Coleman Barney got a $2,300 AR-15 from his wife for Valentine's Day with a night vision scope.
The only thing we didn't know is if it was wrapped up in red paper. Paul, you wanted to say something quick?
All he got was a card. No, I've got nothing. These guys are... I've sat through these kind of trials in Florida where people have weapons and plans to blow up things, and generally they look goofy, but they're dangerous, as they can be.
Well, I think that was really the big point here, that at some point the FBI is saying, well, he is speaking, he does have a right to speak, but do we have to let him kill someone before we charge him? And I guess the jury's response was, no, you don't have to wait for him to kill anyone.
I think once you make the first overt act in that thing, that's the end of you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Steve, you wanted to add something real quick here?
I was impressed with the jury itself, and maybe that had a lot to do with the judges in his demeanor in the trial, but there are a lot of charges here, a lot of moving parts, and it seemed like they paid very close attention to everything. It seems like they asked the right questions, they listened intently, and they came up with some really good decisions here. I just thought the jury did a very
and
good job.
Richard and I both noticed, or Richard more than I, but we discussed it, that there were people that went to sleep in the courtroom, but none of them were the jurors.
Yeah. This was going on at the same time as the Roger Clemens trial going on.
Didn't somebody get thrown off that jury?
There were a few folks. The judge admonished the prosecution and the defense and said, come on, you got to move this along. People are falling asleep. So here you had a very complicated case and First Amendment rights as well and some very deep questions. And these folks seemed to really stay in the game the whole time and made some interesting decisions. It wasn't guilty across the board.
Yeah,
they really thought about each and every charge.
As we believe. Steve, a concern about flooding is growing along the Matanuska River. This isn't the first time we've had this, but what's the latest on this year's version of that story?
Well, it could get worse over the weekend, but this was kind of the perfect storm. You had a deep snowpack from a record snowfall over the winter. You had a rather chilly spring that kept that snowpack intact for a long time, and then all of a sudden, boom, it hit 70 degrees. And we got some rain, quite a bit of rain, too. So you see the Matanuska River now. Last I heard was about 9 feet over its normal depth, and it's there's danger of some flooding, I think, in the Butte area. Other places, though, from the Butte on up into Sutton, it's more of an erosion issue, taking away great chunks of land. That river can be very, very powerful when it gets high like this. So it is the what happened this winter with all that snow, it's still having an effect.
And do we have any idea how many people potentially might be affected if there was a quote-unquote flood?
No, I don't know how many folks actually live in that stretch of the river. We've seen homes, though, consumed by the river where it's taken the riverbank away and the home goes into the into that river. We've also seen the state, we've seen the borough do its best to try and control that river over the years, and that's just a river that's never going to be tamed. It's going to do what it wants to do.
Now, from a policy perspective of the state or federal government, is there anything to be done?
I don't know if you go back and just...
The government's not going to tell people you're living too close to the river.
Right. It's not. And I don't know what you do. I really don't know what you do. It's the same thing of living in Florida, living in Louisiana. Hurricanes show up there and they can do damage. And you just can't tell people, well, you can't live here.
And presumably one of the reasons people would live there is land is fairly cheap to acquire.
Sure,
you can build a house and it's beautiful.
It's a beautiful area and you have the river there. Sometimes it's in your kitchen though.
We're going to move back to federal court with Paul Jenkins, and the situation or the subject is a little bit different this time. This is not militiamen, this is strippers in federal court have their day and win a judgment against their former employer.
I knew nothing about
And this is
strippers.
A real judgment.
Even though I've read about them extensively. In 1987, the Supreme Court said strippers are not contract workers in Alaska. They are, in fact, employees and subject to labor laws and the Federal Labor Act and that sort of thing. We have three strippers here in town who said, wait a minute, you guys have, you've gypped us out of $324,000, and they sued. And judges decided they get $150,000 because of the evading the Federal Labor Act and Alaska Wage and Hour Law, and said that the businesses treated them like contract employees and shuffled off business expenses onto their shoulders when business got tight. So they're owed the money. So I figure somewhere in town there's a bank getting big crates of $1 bills to pay this off. It'll be a great thing.
And of course, there's the possibility that they still have to collect the money. And
they have to collect the money. There is, of course, they can appeal and all that.
Some element.
At some point, they get. At some point, they're going to wind up with $1 bills.
This is another case that gave us some a window on an industry that we just don't hear, or a business or an activity we don't hear much about.
Well, no, and I think they would tell you at places like this across the country, these women are taken advantage of. That's boom. That's it. Alaska, I think rightly in 87, said, look, these aren't contract employees. They're your employees. You got to pay them. And I think I saw a similar case to this down south that they wound up paying too. because in fact they're unemployed.
There's a whole labor law that revolves around these kind of cases, and if you read some of the cases, they have names like Jane Williams, a.k.a. Brandy Alexander, versus the Kit Kat Club, LLC. Steve, the special session of the legislature cost almost $500,000.
Yeah.
What'd the Alaskan public get for their money?
Well, they got a human trafficking law that was passed. Very important piece of legislation, truly is, to protect people who are most vulnerable, I think, in our society. So that came out. So one out of three could win you a batting title in the American League. The other two bits of legislation that was on the oil taxes that the governor so badly wanted, and the in-state natural gas pipeline. Once the oil tax issue was pulled off the table by the governor, Senate said, we're out of here. And then 4 days later, the House followed suit. So they got granted a very important piece of information, of legislation passed in this human trafficking bill, but there's still two pieces of information that
and the public seems to really have disdain for special sessions and the bill for them, but I never heard anybody losing an election because of going to a special session or spending a bunch of money on it.
No, this one though, I don't know what the ramifications are for this. I don't know if the governor came out looking pretty bad on this one, but he still has a couple more years to go on his term. Voters have short memories.
Here's one ramification. We're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us right here on Alaska Edition, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.